Welcome to Regenerative Mindset. In this podcast, we'll explore fresh ideas and inspiring stories from trusted voices who share practical wisdom on bringing positive change to our lives, our society, and our world. I'm your host, Stacey Pollice. As a psychologist, regenerative farmer, and climate activist, I've developed a deep curiosity for thriving ecosystems. Whether it's on my avocado ranch in Southern California or in the ways we engage with each other. Join me as I chat with brilliant guests who challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of how we can live more sustainably, healthfully, and regeneratively, to give back more than we take. Together, we'll see how personal healing can create a ripple effect that reaches our communities and even the earth beneath our feet. So let's get curious together. Today, I'm honored to welcome Zainab Salbi, best-selling author, media host, and founder of award-winning Daughters for Earth and Women for Women International. Named one of the 100 most influential women by Time magazine, Zainab shares her upbringing in Iraq and close proximity to Saddam Hussein's reign of power, which drove an early passion for uplifting and empowering women worldwide. In our conversation, she highlights why women's leadership and experience on the ground are crucial to transforming male-dominated narratives on both international conflict and climate change toward global peace and safeguarding our planet. Zainab recounts how a mysterious illness and near-death experience suddenly interrupted her path in public media, ultimately leading to a profound healing of her body and spirit in nature. Given the clear message that kindness is the key, she advocates for each generation of women to push the next to become their most engaged and empowered selves. Join us for a compelling conversation on activism, empathy, and the power of personal transformation. Hi, Zainab. It's so good to see you. Thanks for being here today.
It is good to see you. I've been waiting for this for a while now. I'm excited.
Besides you being an author, a media host, you have a fabulous TED Talk. There's so much to say about what you've done, and I would encourage listeners to go check out all of it. I've just finished Freedom is an Inside Job, and it's fabulous. It's a guide. Could you do me a favor and the listeners and just give us that basic background of your story and where you came from, just in case they're not aware of you as one of the most influential women in the world?
If you haven't figured it out from my accent, I'm born and raised in Baghdad, Iraq. And Iraq is known as a country that has gone through so much wars in the last few decades. And I did grow up in war, the war with Iran. But in truth, my life before that was a beautiful life, actually. I grew up in a very happy family, a very loving family. And things start to unwind. Three things happen. One is a war with Iran, and I was only 11 years old when that happened. It was at an early stage I realized that the world only covers wars from men's perspective, because as a child, I would look at the news and it's only men who are talking about the war or fighting in the war. As a child, it was only the women who are running my life. The teachers were women, the doctors were women, the police women were women. Everyone was a woman. My mother was a woman. And honestly, I remember as a child, I was standing in front of TV and says, oh, they're only seeing the war from them as men see it from a frontline perspective, they're not seeing the war as I am seeing it from a woman's perspective, the backline perspective. That has become a major influence in my life. The second influence in my life was Saddam Hussein, because he's known in the world as the dictator. But for me also, I knew him, or rather I called him Uncle Saddam. My family was chosen by him to be his social friends, not political friends. My father was a pilot. My mother was a teacher. They had no political ambition and they were safe in that way. Formally speaking, my father was the head of Iraqi civil aviation and Saddam Hussein's private pilot. Informally speaking, we were one of his social circles, one of three families. And that, perhaps more than war, it had a huge impact on my life. Huge. Simply because I was that much closer to fear and dictatorship and worry and danger. My memoir is called Between Two Worlds because the outside world, so was us friends of Saddam Hussein. But inside, we feared him. And he killed his best friends just as much as he killed his oppositions outside. And yet I also knew him as Uncle Saddam. Not because we were related to him, but because that's how you call an older person in your family. And I saw that the devil is a fallen angel. And I have memories of him dancing and laughing. And I have memories of fear with him. So that really impacted my relationship with power, the meaning of power, corruption, understanding fear. When I wrote my memoir, I was like, how can I explain to Americans the meaning of fear? Because for me, it was a very tangible thing. But it's hard to explain it for people who do not understand or have not grown up in that circumstances. What saved me and what hurt me was being a woman. As in, I grew up with a feminist mother. She was the first feminist I've known in my life. She made me read all these feminist books when I was a child. And she told me all about women's oppression and women's liberation as a teenager. So that helped me, as in when I was 16 years old, I was like, Mama, when I grow up, I'm going to help all women around the world. And she looked at me and she said, and yes, you can, honey. And that made all the difference in my life. And sure enough, I ended up dedicating my life to women's rights. But being a woman also hurt me in so many different ways. In a society that where being a woman, being a beautiful woman, was dangerous. You know, Saddam raped a lot of the women around him. But as I became a woman, there was a lot of fear and anxiety around my presence, me, or any other adult woman. Being a woman ended up leading me to come to America in an arranged marriage. Not because my family was traditional. They were very liberal and very progressive secular family, but that was the only way that they could get me out of Iraq. And so here's the feminist mother who's progressive, all of that, gets me in an arranged marriage. And actually, that's how I arrived in America exactly 34 years ago and 1 month, basically, June 15, 1990.
And how old were you again?
I just turned 20. And that took me a long time to understand that she did that to save me and to protect me from Saddam's grazes. And except I was raped by the very husband that I was married off to and end up escaping from him 3 months after because my mother, as a teenager, she told me, never let anybody touch you or talk to you the wrong way. You must always be financially independent as a woman. You must always be strong. And that really stayed with me. So when my husband, you know, was violating me and doing all the things she told me never to accept, I didn't doubt myself when I escaped from him. And that's how my life started in America. In summer 1990, I escaped from him. I had $400 from my pocket. Now, you have to understand, being friends with Saddam, I grew up with a lot of financial privileges, let's say it this way, right? Being friends of the president. And then the pendulum the other way, it goes from that extreme privilege to $400 in my pocket with two suitcases, nice clothes, fashion designer's clothes, but $400 in cash in my pocket, escaping an abusive marriage. And that's how I started my life in America. And that's how my second chapter in my life started, where I end up staying here. The first Gulf War happened. I end up not seeing my family for 9 years. And very soon after, I realized that there are other wars around me. I only grew up in the one war I knew, which is with Iran. And it was my first awareness of other wars around me. I went back to school in America in college. And that's when I learned for the first time, to be honest, about the Holocaust. And it was the first month I learned about the genocide that was happening in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And for me, I was 22 at the time. And I was like, they said never again, but the exact same thing happening again, different people. I must do something. And that started my second chapter in my life. Now, mind you, I grew up with lack of freedom. And so when I came to America, it was freedom. And freedom for me is still like a delicious chocolate. You know, the fact that you can speak up your mind and not be killed or persecuted, that you can tell your truth and you're okay. Now, of course, over time, I learned this a lot more complicated in America, but still you have more freedom. You still have that value of freedom that is so precious and so uniquely American, to be honest. And for me, discovering it for the first time, it was not only exciting, but also I felt responsibility. I felt like now that I live in a land that gave me the freedom, I must do something about injustice. As a human being, it's my responsibility. And I believed, and I believe now, that if I don't do something about injustice, then I legitimize that injustice. And worse, I also allow for the corruption of my own values. Because in truth, we all think that we are good people. But what's the point of thinking of ourselves of being good people if we do not walk the walk, if we do not implement and live by our values? So for me, it was a time in which I saw an injustice in front of me of a country I never heard of. And I felt responsibility to do something. And that's how the birth of Women for Women International came. I was 23 years old at the time, 3 years after my arrival to America. And I started as a mom and pop. Everyone laughed at me. I had remarried someone I chose for love. And I started with saying, no, I have to do something with their rape camps and concentration camps happening in a country. I don't care if I don't know it or I don't know the people. I have to do something. And long story short, what started by helping 33 women in September 1993 has so far impacted 570,000 women directly, connected another 500,000 women to them, raised $150 million to women directly, each giving $30 a month and exchanging a letter and a picture with a woman she's helping in a war zone. And that helped massive number of women eventually getting education, training program, and helping them rebuild their lives after war destroyed it.
Wow. Isn't that something? $30. Per person. I mean, that just expands the notion of what you've done or what it has done with your help. Amazing.
It made me believe in the possibilities of change. It made me believe in making the impossible possible. I'm an immigrant woman who started my life with nothing. And I was like, if I could do that, so can everybody else. It made me mostly believe in the power of women. There is nothing for me more powerful than women getting together and getting the job done. It's not always like that because we always also elbow each other and gossip about each other. But when women get together, I am a believer. I'm a believer in the power of women and in the power of the people coming together and getting things done.
Grassroots and women. And so I'd never heard you tell the story where your upbringing during war, because you were surrounded by women, that you had an even stronger impression of what women could do together. That's unique.
I never connected that dot either until now.
The men were busy making their war.
Yes, it's true. I am 54 years old, never connected that dot. It is true. I grew up in the land of women. I mean, because the men were out. And so everyone around me were women and they got the job done. They run the country.
For all intents and purpose, yeah. How did your mom become that lady? How come she was a feminist at that time? Was she raised by a feminist? Do you know?
She was raised by, it makes me emotional to be honest. My mom had passed away since then. She had Lou Gehrig's disease and the process of her passing, to be honest, is what she gave me her truth of the, why she sent me in an arranged marriage. So I always say my mom's biggest gift for me is not only raising me, but also the process of her death, because she gave me truth. And that truth liberated me from my pain. But I come from a lineage of women. On the one hand, my grandmother, my mom's mother, was an orphan and married as a child to my grandfather. And she did not finish her education. She had, I think, only went to elementary school, and she made sure that her daughters go to college. And like, so each generation of women pushed the other women. But my great grandmother was a very wealthy woman and a very educated woman. And she was a strong woman. So honest to God, I'm not unique. All the women in my family are like that. So I have both the strong woman in my family. The money was hers, basically. And so the husband reported to her because it's her wealth that he managed, basically. But yet her daughter-in-law was this uneducated orphan child that she married to her son. And so both are part of my reality. But the point is, each generation made sure that the generation after them is better. So my grandmother ensured all of her daughters goes to college. And all my aunts made sure all of their daughters go to even higher education. And they were clear. It's almost like the way they communicated to me is that each generation of women must push the other generation to get better and better and better. Now we have expressions of intergenerational trauma, or I also think that we should pay attention to intergenerational joy, but like how we push each other until our liberation, each generation gets closer to our freedom and liberation. And I would say my mother tried to help me do that.
That is a great story. And I think also what I hear is inspiration, inspiration for liberation and empowerment. And it sounds to me like from a young age, you felt passion for these causes at a very large scale, because the scale of work that you've done since you were very young is global. And that is not common for someone to start that way. And I just was thinking about you and thought, wow, you are a global citizen and you operate at a global level.
Honestly, I think I'm blessed to have known my calling at such a young age. Is it intentional on my end? Is it training on my mother's end? I don't know. I really don't know. The fact that I was 16 years old and I knew what I'm going to do in my life and followed through that, and I end up doing what I'm doing in life, you know, only, you know, at 23 or 22, it's a gift. It's a blessing, because I see so many other people who don't know their purpose in life yet. I think it's painful not to have that calling very clear. I don't know. But the fact that I had it clearly and it happened to put me in a trajectory that is passionate for me and my truth, I'm extremely grateful, to God for that gift.
As I understand, so you've built this incredible organization, but as I understand it, at around the 20-year anniversary of you having started this organization, you decided to take a pause, take a step back. Can you say a little bit more about that? Because I think there's a lot of courage, wisdom, and it's not what everyone would do when you're really doing well and riding a high wave. People don't stop and hold back. Can you speak to that a little bit? But I love that you did it.
I really appreciate that you bring that up, because not many people, you know, bring that out. And usually people only want to talk about the rise, not the plateau. It wasn't plateau. I chose to leave. There are a few reasons why I chose. One is when I started Women for Women, I was 23 years old formally. And I said, I promised myself that when it is 20 years old, I will leave it. And partially because I was studying women's studies at the time, and I was learning all about the founder syndrome and how founders keep on holding on and not letting go. And I was like, I do not want to be that. Partially because I grew up under a dictator. And that is, I mean, it's very emotional for me still, despite all the work I had to do on myself. The idea of, like, I spent a lifetime not to be like him, because he's the patriarch in my life. That is Saddam Hussein. And I was not oblivious to the corruption of power when I was growing up with him. I was clear about the corruption of power. And I'm grateful for my parents making me understand power at a young age and how not to use it, basically, because it was easy. You understand, people were afraid of us. So my parents would instruct me, never use the fact of who you are in anything. It came out of a struggle with the meaning of power and leadership. I did not want to be a leader, what I'm trying to say. I only started Women for Women International to follow my heart and my calling. I was just being true to myself, but I did not want to be a leader and I did not want to be in power.
Can I say one thing? Leader the way it has been defined by men? Could we say that?
Yeah. Well, it took me a long time to understand that. Actually, I credited that to Oprah, because I was like so scared of leadership up until a few years ago. And she said, what are you scared of? And I said, because I have such a bad experience with it. So I'm so scared of it. And she said, you don't think it is what it's been done or defined. You define it your own way. You define what leadership is in your own values. But that was only a few years ago when I heard her say that, and that changed everything in my life. But up until then, I was rejecting the idea of being in a position of leadership and thus the power implications with it. So much so that I remember one time I went to the Democratic Republic of Congo to visit the women that were supporting, and there were thousands of women. Thousands of women. And I turned around and they were like, which scared me to death, honestly. They were all saying, Zainabu, which is how my name is said in Africa. And I was like, oh my God, what have I done? I had no idea that there were thousands of women marching. It was a moment in my life that I remember Alice Walker was with me. And she is a mentor and a mother-like figure and a friend. And I looked at her scared because there were thousands of women. And I did not want to be a leader. I was just following my calling. And I looked at her as like, panic, what do I do? And she said, own it and speak to them. It was really beautiful. And I am blessed to also have all these amazing women who were coaching me. But it took me a long time to own my own power and my own voice. But leaving Women for Women was partially to demonstrate the letting go of leadership. It came from that desire of me to learn what it means to let go of power and leadership. And because everyone can find group, and I always say, I am as proud of leaving it as I am of founding it, because not many people leave their position of power willingly. But a lot of people find and thrive and all of these things. So that's another reason. The third reason was the Arab Spring had also happened. They all collided at the same time. And I wanted to go back and contribute something to my part of the world.
So I am struck by the notion that women seeing themselves as leaders may be informed by something they have experienced negatively through an example of male leadership without knowing it. You had such an extreme example through being at the center of power. And what I heard you say, correct me if I'm wrong, is that being at the center of power with Saddam Hussein was not the safest place to be. There was plenty of fear and danger in that proximity, but that you had such a pronounced example, you had it built into your system that I never want to step into that role. Powerful. And then you had to take that on and do it. Was that hard to actually do, even though you knew to do based on your own inner dictates?
Tell me more, like the leaving?
So I want to say that the leaving, based on you had an intention to do so, you had an experience of not wanting to take on more power in the position through longevity, possibly, through staying with it. But even having those convictions, was it difficult to make that step back and to take that pause? Or was it like, oh, that's the only thing I feel like doing right now? Was it scary?
It was very scary. It was also a time of shedding for me. My second husband, who continues to be my best friend, though we are no longer married, and I also got divorced during that time. So it was years of shedding for me. And I use the example of my divorce as an example of my separation of Women for Women. It's like, I chose to do that. And the ordeals of the details was very irritating. In my ex-husband's case, we went to the divorce court holding hands. And I still, there were moments of irritation, even though it was the most friendly divorce ever. And it's the same with Women for Women. So even though I chose it, it was still painful and irritating and all of the things that comes with it. And I also thought it was humbling, to be honest, because by the time I left it, I was in my mid-40s right now. And I knew the vision of what I wanted to start. So I only paused for a year to take a sabbatical and rest. And I wrote a book in that time. But I went to do this mega opera-esque show in the Arab and the Muslim world. And to start something in my mid-40s, in a sector I do not know about, which is the media, was extremely humbling. Honestly, I live to be very proud of this whole experience, but of course it was not easy. Even though I chose it, I stepped into it. It was painful. It was like I had an identity issue, trying to separate between me and Women for Women International. And, you know, people, when they called me, I was like, oh, no, I'm not running Women for Women. It's okay. And they're like, oh, no, we're calling you. We want you. I was like, what? You see me? You know, it was a lot of issues that I had, but I still went for it. I still moved along with it. And also people not knowing how to relate to me during that time, because people would say, what are you doing now? And I'm like, the year of the sabbatical, nothing. No, really, what are you doing? Honestly, I'm doing nothing. I am resting. I'm hiking. Okay, I'm working on a book, but that was easy book to write, you know, nothing. And they didn't know how to relate to me if I was doing nothing. It was easier to relate to me if I was that badass woman who was traveling to war zones and all of that. There was an image. But to say not much is going on in my life was also disorienting, not only for me, but for others, actually, you know, in that case. So it was disorienting.
Of course, because you were a superhero. What a teaching. And what I want to just say here is that as a regenerative farmer, as one who notices these ecosystems, the idea of rest is essential in the balance and in the health of all systems. So it is a teaching to accentuate this. This is a huge teaching that you are living by example, to take that step back and to wrestle with what comes up when there's silence, when there's spaciousness. That is a very spiritual practice, I will say. Not sure if you knew you were doing that, but that's how I interpret it.
I'm grateful for it. The real spiritual practice came later for me, where I was conscious, oh my God, this is what's happening. In that period, I was watching myself because it's humbling. I was watching my identity. What is my identity? I also let go of all support system around me. So from having so much staff, I was managing 700 staff to going alone.
Managing 700 doesn't quite sound like support. 700 people supporting you or you?
Yeah. No, we had 700 staff members, but I'm the CEO of that. So it was a lot of work and I had lots of support. But I went from that to alone and tried to hear, frankly, my pulse again. Because, you know, when you're a system and you're working, you don't hear yourself again. And so I needed to go into silence just to hear my heart's pulse. Who am I again, right? Like, what is my rhythm? Which one is me and which one was the others? Which is my voice and which is the institution's voice? I had to like shut through that. And then also the humility of having to start all over again. You don't migrate the credibility of, especially if I'm migrating from one sector to another sector, I had to start from the beginning again with the media sector, basically. So I live to be extremely grateful to that zigzagging journey in my life. But it wasn't a smooth ride, let me just say it that way, at all.
Especially for the ego, shall we say?
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, that's what I write about in Freedom is an Inside Job. It's definitely for the ego, because it's like, who am I? What am I? So in association with my identity in the world, the founder of Women for Women International, the media person, the author, the award, blah, blah. Or am I beyond that? The third chapter in my life was really understanding who truly I am outside of these external definitions. It was also a filtering process. It was fascinating for me witnessing people who were like, hi, Zainab, before, and then like just not paying any attention after. Or people who said, oh, no, we like you for who you are. We don't care. It was fascinating to see how the rhythm around you was changing.
And who was there for what reasons is what you're saying. Yeah, which can be painful and it can be freeing, can be liberating. Yeah, simplifying.
It was more liberating in my case. Yeah.
We spoke because we share a couple of things in common. One is we both experienced a near-death experience. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I would love to hear a little bit more. You and I just really touched on it, and there are some parallels here. And for me, it is just compelling and profound.
It was for me very profound because you don't get to meet people who you go right to the heart and the core of the issue so fast. So I built my media career. I started with the Pan Arab Show, which was an award-winning show in the midst of ISIS, Women Power. It was a very audacious and very courageous show. And I got celebrated in the West while crucified in the East. I ended up coming back to America by choice and not renewing and doing several shows, understanding the world from a woman's perspective. So I stay in my passion of understanding the world forward, that childhood story of war. But now I expanded beyond war. How do we understand art? How do we understand politics? How do we understand our economy? All from a woman's perspective. And I've done many shows and I wrote another book. And in what I call a perfect moment in my life and in my career, all the things that you have a check. Nice love life, check. Nice career, check. Good money, check. Good clothes, check. Vacations, check. Da-da-da, check, 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 check. And I moved from that perfect day into the ER, ambulance, operating room, the ICU, all in 12 hours, and a moment that night in which my body is moving on its own and I cannot breathe. And I believe that this is my last breath. And there were doctors around me and nurses and all of these things and family around me. But it was really fascinating for me how that moment changed everything in my life. Because up until that moment, no matter what, whether doing Women for Women or all the media shows and the books I've written and all of that, I was still measuring myself by how many women I have helped and impacted. And there was never enough. And it's a fascinating psychology, I have to say, because when I tell people that, they said, oh, but you're a humanitarian, that's so sweet. I'm like, no. The psychology of that is, frankly, as deformed as someone is counting how much money they have, and no matter how much money they have, they want more and they feel that they're poor. Or how many cars they have, and no matter how many cars they have, they still want more and they feel that they're poor. Or clothes or food. It doesn't matter. We're measuring.
Counting, comparing.
Exactly. You don't feel it's big enough. It's not big enough. It's not big enough. You see, that psychology is still sick psychology. It doesn't matter if I am measuring on people as opposed to people measuring on cars, let's say, you know, or clothes, you know, it doesn't matter. In that second where I'm taking my last breath, it is a very intimate moment, as you know, between oneself and one's heart. You are alone in that second. And as I think that I'm leaving, I don't think, did I accomplish enough? The only word that comes is kindness. And the only question that comes is, did I live my life in kindness to myself and to others? But mostly, did I live my life in kindness? And then the doctors intervene and I'm able to breathe and all of that. But I am stunned at that moment of awareness, kindness. Did I live my life in kindness? And did I live my life in love? And the truth is, I don't think I had. I mean, obviously, as a humanitarian who has dedicated my life to service, I have lived my life in kindness and in love to the larger collective, to the global world, to the others. But if you ask me, what is kindness to yourself means, I would have said, I get massages between now and then, or I get a manicure and a pedicure. And there's a huge difference I came to discover between self-care and kindness. That's maintenance. That's just putting an oil on your machine so you can keep going with the massage, right? Just because a bicycle will not work if you don't put some oil between now and then. That's different. Kindness is a very, very different meaning to oneself. And I was extremely sick for a year and a half. I ended up having to move from the city. I had to live in nature exclusively. I could not see humans. I could not hear the sound of any machines. And that was the most profound spiritual experience of my life. Because I not only almost lost my life in that week, I lost all the work I had, all my shows. I lost it in that week. My boyfriend left me in the hospital that week. It was a week of loss, from having it all to like nothing. I lost my ability to think. whatever I had, it's an unknown viral infection, impacted my cognitive ability. So I would be struggling to speak with you the way I would speak. I would think of a word in my head, but I cannot articulate it outside. And I moved from I am this to who am I? If I cannot think, if I cannot write, if I cannot walk, if I can barely breathe, then who am I? It is a beautiful world. I am so grateful. I miss it, to be honest, to that I don't want to be sick again. But I miss that exposure to this beautiful layer of life in which all what I was able to do at that time is meditate for hours, is walk in nature for hours, and cook. And I learned how to play the piano again. And poetry was pouring out of me. And after a year and a half of only doing that, I came with my 7 rules of a happy day. I came out of this experience with extreme joy, not little joy, extreme joy, and at my connection with my heart, with earth, with the divine, and ultimately with others, with people. And ultimately, I came to answer the question of how dare you ask who I am? I am. And who I am became not relevant to whether I'm up or low in the day, if I am celebrated or despised, if I am successful or failure, doesn't matter. Who am I? It's just I am. And that's was the first step to my liberation. That was my ultimate liberation, to understand the I am.
Wow. That is so profound. And you have just named, I did some study, I'm not sure if you're familiar, but studying near-death experience, and that they tend to have qualities in common with each other. Again, I'm going to bring up our friend Nancy. She introduced me to the study of near-death experience, and that people who do go through this experience have these things in common, that you become typically more spiritual, not religious, more connected to nature, more clear in your soul's purpose. But the odds on someone staying in the same relationship is something like 5% after 5 years. Because typically your personality changes to be more in alignment with your divine soul purpose. And I know the feedback I was receiving shortly thereafter was, wow, you're so direct. I maybe was a little more diplomatic and I might go around the bend to say what I needed to say. And since then, it's just like, nope, here it is. Even though it may seem like a paradox, it's more compassion toward other, more empathy, more intuition. I don't know if you've got that as well.
Yeah. It's interesting because for me, the feedback, everyone around me gave me a feedback that I have changed as a result. And in my case, I am someone who survived wars and had to work in wars and report from wars for basically up until that experience. People's feedback was when I walked into rooms, like, you know, I have shields around me, partially because I had to like survive wars and, you know, live in wars and negotiate with militias to protect other women. And they're like, oh, wow, we had no idea this is who you are when the shields are not on. It's an interesting concept about the shields, because we all have shields around us to protect us because we're afraid to show who we are. And yet we can never move on in life. I like Star Trek. When the ship is being attacked, they say shields on, you know, Captain Picard, shield on, right? The ship cannot move when the shields are on. The only way the ship can move into warp speed when the shields are off. When we have our shields on because we're so afraid, in many ways, we're not telling the truth, as you were saying in your case. We're not moving. We're not being honest about our lives, you know, because our shields are on, shields off. This is who I am. This is who it is. And you can move freely, bounce more freely and joyfully when the shields are off. Because for me, the second transformation is a deep, deep appreciation for everything in life. Of course, we appreciate the nice moments of like being in nature, but I meditate every day. That's my rules of a happy day. It's very important for me. I call it an appointment with my heart. And sometimes I open my eyes and I see my orange sofa, which I love. And I start giggling and I tear up of gratitude that I could have this orange sofa. Now, it's so frivolous, right? But the truth is how much we buy things and then we forget them and we pass by them every day and we forget that we appreciate that object or that plant so much. And now the pausing, the meditation, the appointment with my heart takes me back to that slowness that I was in when I was ill. You see life in a different layer. And every aspect of it, a ray of light or the orange sofa or some leaf, the smallest and the silliest aspect of it becomes for me a source of huge gratitude and huge joy.
Wow. You just said it. I mean, you are speaking my experience too. So I really do understand. And my practice as well is the thing that reconnects me. I never have given it up. And it's 2 hours a day. Most days I get it in different points in the day, but it's absolutely my connection because I don't ever want to get past that. It's interesting. A man named Eben Alexander wrote a book called Proof of Heaven. And I was just peeking at that again. Neurosurgeon, Ivy League educated, rationalist, had a mysterious virus, had a near-death experience. And he also spends a lot of time in meditation to stay connected to the characters that he met while he was in that space.
I really understand. And my experience for me, because when my mind was not functioning and I had to spend most of my time in my heart, I came to learn that the heart has a language and the heart has wisdom. And like when we need to learn any language, English, Arabic, French, Spanish, Italian, whatever language, we actually have to study the language. We have to practice. I relearned how to play the piano. As I said, music is a language. You can't play music. You have to practice every single day in order to perfect the piece. And I think of the heart as the same way. The only way we can learn the heart's language is if we go and visit it and learn it and practice it and hear it every single day. And that's why I call it an appointment with my heart. It's not just meditation. It's an appointment. For me, it's a conscious relationship between me and my heart. Because when I was about to die, and then I meditate after that, I see an image of my heart holding my hands and saying, "Don't leave me again." And I am a heart-led person. So you know me and you're like, "Oh, Zainab is full of love." I may have showed love and kindness to the faraway others, but I didn't spend time with my heart. And it's like to respect it and to honor it. And it becomes a very different relationship. The days I don't do it, I was like, "I'm so sorry, I missed our appointment today." When I enter to my heart temple, is trying to polish my understanding of that language. And it may take me a lifetime to understand my language of my heart, but I have to be disciplined in that relationship.
And it's so satisfying. That discipline ends up being the most satisfying. Well, it's interesting when you talk about the piano, but also anything, is that they say you play by heart. You know, you can learn a poem by heart. And that's a different experience than memorizing. Brilliant. It's a different feeling, I think. And I think we could probably do a lot of things two different ways by heart. I really am so fascinated with this, and we'll talk more, but I also want to ask you about, did this experience that you had, this incapacity of your intellectualization, deeper connection to Mother Earth, let's say, where the women are running the show, and this new project that you had come up with, can you speak about that? Was it after that that Daughters for Earth came about?
It was as a result of it. I mean, before that, I was asked by my co-founder, Jody Allen, what's happening with women in climate change? How can we support them? And so I was doing some research here and there, but to be honest, it was not my issue. You know, climate change, I don't understand what's happening. I'm an ethical citizen, I call it, you know, do all the things that they tell us the checklist. But I wasn't into it until I had this profound connection to nature and earth during that year and a half. I still live in nature exclusively, but in that time, I was not moving and I was not able to walk and breathe, as I said. And I felt nature became my best friend. Honestly, I felt like the trees, they're like, you can do it, sister. You can do it. You can breathe. I felt like the ocean wave would give me like electric shock to my lungs. You can breathe. Nature became my best friend in that time. And I'm still obsessed with nature, how unbelievable it is in wisdom and in experience and knowledge and beauty. I mean, even the broken trees are beautiful, for God's sake.
There's a way it all fits in Mother Nature. It all has a role. There's no rejection.
Exactly. There is no rejection. Here we are living in a world where people are trying to make themselves perfect. It's the imperfection that is gorgeous in nature. Anyway, I came out of it saying, I owe it to Mother Earth to thank it for saving me. I viscerally believe I was saved by Mother Earth, like in the hearts of my heart. And nature saved me. And I remember making a vow to it. I don't understand climate change, but I understand women. And I will do everything in my capacity to thank Mother Earth by supporting and mobilizing women. And that was my vow. That's my way of thanking her. And so from that, I called my co-founder, Jody Allen, and I was like, this is big. It's a big gap. Women are impacted severely by climate change. There's a lot of data that shows all of that. But what we're not talking about, that women on the front lines of protecting the earth, front lines of conservation efforts, biodiversity protection, regenerative agriculture, and they're doing it, some of them because they know this, there is some because it's the right thing to do. And they're always doing it by bringing everyone along the journey with them. Always the community, their families, the larger communities with them. And they're getting 0.2% of all philanthropic dollars that is going to the issue. And the protection of nature and biodiversity is getting 2% of philanthropic dollar. It's my heart and my mind coming together. My mind is the feminist. I was like, I am pissed off at again another injustice that women are facing. And my heart is, let me bring it back to a very personal issue for me, besides my vow to nature. I come from Iraq. My country was destroyed, partially by America and the Allies, but partially also by Iraqis through ISIS. Last time I went to Iraq was 3 weeks after ISIS was overthrown. And I walked in their capital, Mosul, at that time. And I was just talking to people, and people were saying that we need new value systems with new human beings, because that all values of the promise of money and power failed us. And we kept on killing each other, killing the other, until our sons turned the guns on us. I remember a woman viscerally saying, she says, I will rebuild my home. I will clear the rubble from my front door, but I need help understanding what are these new value systems. And I have come a full circle believing the new value systems comes from nature itself. We don't need to invent it in our head. It's right there in front of us. And if we just spend enough time to observe how every aspect of nature acts and reacts in so many ways. And so for me, the birth of Daughters of Earth and supporting women who are on the front lines of climate change and protection of nature by funding them, by celebrating the heck out of them, that by giving data and showing that you invest in women's protection of earth is one of the best investments you can do actually in climate change, and by mobilizing those who are not otherwise mobilized to be part of the conversation. That for me brings my whole life together. My understanding of new value systems coming from Message of the Abyss, as they call it, from Iraq. My gratitude to nature. My belief in women and women's ability to mobilize and get the job done. My understanding of kindness and how do we have to operate in our world in a new way. For me, all of that brings a full circle in the birth of daughters for Earth. Honestly, there's a Sufi saying that says, "Oh, break my heart. Oh, break my heart again so I can love even more." And I have come to understand that saying, "Oh, break my heart. Oh, break my heart again so I can love even more." Because if it wasn't for all the heartbreaks that I have encountered, Daughters for Earth would not have been born. In 2 years, we have mobilized $30 million to support women on the front lines of climate change. In 36 countries, we've created graphic novels about the unsung hero to tell the world there's, yes, the Jane Goodalls, but there's so many more. And let's celebrate them and let's understand them and let's see the connections between what they are doing and protecting the mangroves here or the rivers here or the fish here and climate change. And how can we all create change in our lives, in our personal lives? And all of it for me came together into a moment where I am truly grateful, grateful every single day. And the day I'm not, because I'm running fast or I'm tired, whatever, all what I need to do is go back to my heart and it re-anchors me again.
I mean, this experience has given you tools that are a guiding light for life. The impact this program has had so far, so fast, within 5 years or less, obviously, because...
2 years. 2 years, 2 months.
2 years. Wow. Something that I was hearing you say was the imagination, that we need to reclaim our imagination from our heart. It's about love. And you also say somewhere, we need to build the world from the inside out, which is that inside job. And so what I want to remind you is that maybe a year after I had been healing from my near-death experience, I heard climate change is an inside job. And I was on our land. I suddenly knew I have been healing myself and that only through healing this and all the ways that I healed after my near-death experience, by healing that, only then can I bring a new energy, a new direction, a new perspective that is healed. When I bring a perspective that is out of balance, that is depleted, that is overworked, what am I going to bring to the world? So that's how I understood it. But you take everything and just blow it global, which is fabulous. So we need to engage our imagination. And imagination at its fullest is not taught in schools. They engage our imagination for memorization, which isn't the same thing. There's possibility and futuricity in pure imagination. And that's what I hear you saying. What can you possibly think of? Like, what are our new values? Dream it up. Dream it up.
Yeah. I mean, the world we live in is a product of our imagination. So we might as well reclaim our imagination. We have no choice but to reclaim our imagination.
That's where it all started anyway. Somebody saw it.
Exactly, exactly. And I want to comment also about how climate change is an inside job, because now I giggle with my excitement because I spend my day learning about what women are doing. And for them, for the women on the front lines, it is interconnected. Their liberation and Earth protection, violence against women, violence against Earth, because it's the same mentality that creates this disruption is creating disruption for all. And it's the same mentality that creates this restoration, creates restoration for the self and for the Earth. It's fascinating for me that this is actually true. And I'm witnessing the women doing that.
You have said it so beautifully. So Zainab, I could keep talking forever with you. This has been such a pleasure. But what I really want to ask you now is, what would you love, what action items would you love to send us towards? And how can we be helpful in this beautiful mission, this beautiful vision that you've been gifted? Let's start there.
Well, first, I invite everyone to visit daughtersforearth.com. You can learn about what women are doing, but you can also be a hummingbird. And the hummingbird movement, effect movement we created, is based on a fable that once upon a time there is fire in the forest and all the animals panicked except for a tiny hummingbird. She rushed to the local river, took a drop of water and rushed to the fire and dropped it on top of the fire and kept on going back and forth, so fiercely as hummingbirds always do. And all the big animals criticized her. What are you doing? You know, you're such a tiny hummingbird and tiny drop. You can never turn off the fire. And she turns to them and she said, but I am doing everything possible to turn off the fire, even with my small drop. Why don't you join me? And with that, she inspired all of them to put their own drops of water and turn off the fire and eventually live safely, happily after. So I invite everyone in becoming a hummingbird. It has so many meanings in the world. One is by supporting Daughters for Earth, you actually get the hummingbird graphic novel of a woman and what she is doing to protect the earth and learning the science behind her and what can you do to protect the earth yourself and your environment. So that's the least I'm asking, that I hope as many people join us as possible. But then also we're living in such a tumultuous time and it could be so depressing. And what is the drop? Where is your drop? Where is your hummingbird in your personal life, the inside job in your larger life, you know, the external life? And so we have a choice, I believe, to be depressed and doomed, or we can be as fierce as the hummingbird. I mean, I love them because I am surrounded with them by my home and they bring joy. I refuse to give up. I refuse to give up on love and on joy and on hope. And I invite everyone, everyone, honestly, to find what does that mean for themselves. That's how I came up with my 7 rules of a happy day. It's frivolous. It's just drink a lot of water and eat healthy food and an appointment with my heart. They're not big ones, but each person should understand what does that mean for them? What is their rules for a happy day? Because once we understand it, then we implement it. And once we are living in a state of gratitude and joy and happiness and kindness, I think our contribution to the world, exactly what you said, climate change can be inside job. Our contribution to the world, to this gorgeous earth that we live in, could be so easy and it could be done. So it's join Daughters for Earth and do your own hummingbird for yourself.
Beautiful. Thank you for the blessing. And I'm just so grateful you're here today and more to come.
I am so grateful to you. Truly, I feel like our mutual friend is present. She made this magical connection happen. And I feel like a soul sisterhood, truly. Someone who understands the journey and the loss and the gain again and the gratitude. I see you and I feel seen by you. And for that, I'm grateful.
For tuning in. If today's conversation inspired you, you can help us reach more people by sharing this episode with friends or leave a review. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For additional resources, you can visit my website and stay connected with me on social media. A big thanks to the amazing team that makes this podcast possible, including Phil Svitek, Brianna Phipps, Leah Pellegrini, Melissa Walbridge, and Courtney Hamilton. When we all work together, we can create a world where positive change is not just possible, but inevitable.